Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
When you're making hundreds of wines like we do, this is back to my original point about how difficult it is that you're not trying to make 5 or 10 wines per year, you're trying to make 205. Or 305 or 310 wines per year. And so that's way, way more ambitious than making a handful of wines, because that's, again, you can, still difficult to do. It's difficult to make one good wine. It's exceptionally difficult to make 201 good wines. And so that the hard part is that's the model that we chose to do. And so we get the challenge of trying to achieve that.
Yeah. Does it ever happen when you're sitting down with a client and in the process of blending trials, or just a simple discussion, they're just really unhappy and you have to manage expectations?
So that's a good question, actually. And so particularly in certain wines, like, for example, barrel fermented Chardonnay. Chardonnay and white wines in general, the oak or the style of the wine has a big impact on the of the profile of the wine. So the same, if someone likes Chardonnay and they want a full body Chardonnay, they're not going to be nearly as happy with a neutral barrel. And or vice versa, if they want a wine that has more fruit and less oak impact and less kind of cloying oakiness, then they're going to be much, much, much more happy with, and so someone's been done this before can see, oh, I just put in X%, 5% of the older barrel or the newer barrel into the blend to kind of soften the profile, to change the profile. But someone, this is the first time they've done it before, they've never seen this before, they're like, this wine doesn't work for me. They just don't realize that it doesn't work for them because the profile is just slightly off. If we shift the profile, though, it will work for them. They just don't know that because they haven't done it before. Mm-hmm. So for the first time, particularly when you do it and doesn't immediately match what you're looking for, you think, oh no, this isn't right. You're not thinking, oh no, this is right. How do I change this to make it right? Which is what you should do. And so, but it only comes with experience. Into where making wine for a long time, you know, okay, why isn't it right? It's not right for reasons. They're right. And so what are the reasons? Oh, this is too acidic, or it's not oaky enough, or it's too oaky, or I want more fruit, or I want less fruit, or I want, you know, whatever the reasons are. I want more butter, I want no butter at all. And so there's somewhere in between. There's reasons why you like it or don't like it. And so the reasons are important to know and to discern. And so you may not or may not know why that is, but if you can, but if we taste wine together, I'll quickly know why you don't like it. And so the question is, do I have the things to change it? So for example, if it was too oaky, and you don't like a lot of oak, I would have to shift you to an older barrel of that same wine. We ferment Chardonnay in the barrel, so the wines are significantly different. The fruit profile is still similar because it's the same fruit juice that we're working with, but the barrel has a big impact on the wine. And so either blend or we swap. So in the past, when someone didn't really like it, in the case of, I've had a couple of times where someone had a barrel of wine that they bought and that was like very oaky, and they didn't want it to be really oaky. Okay, then we need to blend it out, or we need to swap it out. And so then we would go to an older barrel, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, this is way better. And like, well, that's because you didn't want as much oak. So it was a calibration error, I guess, if you will. So then we would have, fortunately for me in that case, I would be able to have things like a blend. A lot of times for red wine, it's a blending thing. And so usually, so for example, Cabernet Sauvignon on its own is kind of a, somewhat, I tell people that my preferred shape of a cab is a football shape, an American football shape, which sounds a bit strange. And one side being the front portion of the palate and the other side being the back portion of the palate. A football is balanced in the middle, and so that it's in your, on your palate. If you have a shape, a three-dimensional shape coming through your palate, it's balanced on the mid palate, I think, which is the most attractive, the mid palate, but front to back balanced, as opposed to a soccer ball or something else would be more round and it wouldn't have nearly the finish. So cab, I want the back end on the wine. So I want it to be more kind of have an entrance on the wine and then have a mid palate focus and then have a finish that balances the front palate. So it feels centered on your palate. And so the if you, for example, if a wine we're starting with needed more back end, we might need to shift. You taste the wine, you're like, it's not very good. That's because it doesn't have the finish that we need. So we need to add some Petit Verdot to lengthen the wine. And then you're like, well, the finish is good now, but it still feels flat. We need to add some Merlot or Malbec to inflate that football. And so Cabernet Franc, front sides of the palate, Merlot and Malbec, more mid palate, and PV or Petit Verdot, back end. So it's a ratio thing. We're adjusting the shape, but you not knowing that, you just think, this doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
But the reason why it doesn't work for you is because the blend's not complete. So if you shift the blend around, now the shape changes, now it works for you. But until you've had the experience of knowing that, it's hard. You just know that it doesn't work. You don't know necessarily why it doesn't work. And that's my role to come in and say.
Well, that's especially when you get these folks that come in and say, you know, they might not think it works right then, but they've said, I want this wine to peak in 5 years,
correct,
or 7 years, or
it's,
4 years.
They don't have the experience to know what it feels like. And so to his point, you said, judgment day in this case, as I like to call it, is 4 years down the road or 5 years down the road. And so what does the wine need to be like now so that come judgment day, it puts its best foot forward. Right. And so that's hard for people because...
So it might feel like more or too much.
Yeah. And so early on, the wine's going to seem too acidic and too astringent so that 4 years down the road, as acidity and astringency both dissipate, the perceptible astringency and acidity both dissipate over time, it's the right amount down the road. It's too much now. You have to start with too much now so that later is the right amount. That's really hard to get that understanding, particularly because in the moment it doesn't seem right. It's not right. You don't know it's going to be right. It's just not right. And so that's where the experience comes in handy. And so having done it for over years and seen, again, I used this earlier, I said one of the hard part of being a winemaker is that I'm always looking back over my shoulder in the past to see what I did and then reflecting on it, turn around, decide whether I need to adjust my current trajectory. And so I have to look back, think about it, and turn around, adjust. Look back, think about it, turn around, adjust, or not adjust. And so the hard part is, when do I do that? How do I adjust? And there's no playbook. It comes with experience of doing it over and over and over again. The wine doesn't just stay impressive for X number of years or days. It's a range of impressiveness. It's like a wave. And so where it is and when you want it to be, it's really hard. There's not a science for sure to that. It's touch.
Wow. I love how beautifully you categorize, though. It makes so much sense. Like your bowl analogy, that it's not round, you know, it's that shape, and it's that, again, that storyline, beginning, middle, and end, that keeps coming.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's tough. And as Steve mentioned, it's with wine particularly, you're aiming for down the road, usually some period down the road. Is it 1 year down the road or 1 month? But typically for reds, for sure, years down the road. And to get everything perfect so that it's ready to go, that will be perfect in 2 years from now or 3 years from now, it's very difficult. So that means because it's not perfect right now. And so you have to know what perfect is for 2 years down the road and what that feels like. And as I said, it's not it only comes with doing a lot over and over and over again.
So a lot of life parallels in those comments.
Yeah, no, it's very much
across.
Yeah, it's very much like life. You don't know until you've done it. There's no playbook that says, oh, make this decision or choose this person or go to this particular spot.
There's no fun in that. Yeah.
Do these things. You have to have done it and then say, you know what? I should have stayed out all night. Or maybe I could have gone home.
Thank God I stayed out all night.
Or perhaps thank God, this was the best night ever, but it only knows by staying out all night. You're gonna think some one way or another about it, I'm sure,
No, that's great stuff. In terms of value proposition, it seems like it's some much more cost effective venture to be able to come to you with, a wish list and go through all the, iterations that you described, which is communication related. If you want a wine that's highly customized, but it's also probably more cost effective to have it done for you as opposed to buying 20 cases from a winery or 26, whatever the equivalent of a barrel is, right?
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, essentially making wine in small lots like this is, there's no economy of scale, but essentially people would be, paying us the equivalent of a wholesale price on the wine. And so there's no way they could get the
no
fruit
chance.
Source.
Yeah, no, they have no, yeah. You can't do...
You can't do any of this.
Like, I mean, right now, currently, you can't do this without us. You can't do it. I mean, it really boils down to that.
But you can't go buy any of the wines made from these vineyards at the same price. You could make your own custom.
Oh, yeah, not even close.
You just have to have the appetite. You don't even actually have to have the storage area, because we'll store your wine for you as well. But and we'll ship it wherever you want it shipped, or you just call us and we say, okay, great, here you go. We'll ship your
nice
case
commercial.
Now.
That's
whatever.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I do have to run operations here. but you can't do the sites that we've mentioned earlier in Rutherford or up.
No, you don't have this access. I mean,
you're
really
paying $40 to $50 a bottle for a finished customized product that you can't get for less than
at least $100-$150 a bottle. You know,
and
so
you do everything soup to nuts, the labeling, and it's all included in one price.
That's correct.
Yeah,
and
they can upgrade and do all sorts. I mean, you can get into wine packaging where you can silk screen large formats. I mean, you can do anything. Doesn't always make sense, but if you want it, we can do
it. Yeah, we can do anything, whatever.
Yeah.
It's really exciting, actually.
We could even deliver it, like, doing cartwheels or whatever you want. So that's going to be extra, though.
Yeah, that's good. Mm. You can't do a cartwheel very well, I don't think. So.
No, not like a vertical one.
So are you expanding your program? Are you growing in that sector?
For the Wine Foundry, we're pretty steady where we are. Okay. You know, we've got a great client base that... we do right around anywhere from 270 to 300-ish, 320, I guess, barrels a year. And that's a nice little sweet spot. Mm-hmm. A lot of my efforts and efforts of a few other partners and people on the team are going towards the brand.
Okay.
With the Anarchist brand. And that's, it's like we touched on earlier, that all of these things kind of feed into each other, mm-hmm. and make for a really healthy operation. It also makes it fun for us as professionals to not just do the same thing every single day, you know, and to come in and have a different challenge. And, we hadn't started a brand before, and so we started a brand. We opened a tasting room. Now we're working on distribution and all that, and growing our wine club. And so looking at, takes everything from, really analyzing the collateral you have when somebody comes in for a tasting, what you have on your website, all of that. And so you're just constantly kind of re-engineering that stuff. And it, similar to what Patrick was saying, where it's like data points all throughout the winemaking process, it's data points all throughout the marketing or sales or operations process. And so I think it's great if the Wine Foundry grows. We have the flexibility to be able to do that. We have terrific vineyard partners that are really great, to where we've, every few years we have to call and say, hey, can I get another 5 tons out of this block? Can you, and they'll squeeze it out for us and find it for us. And so we can grow easily when we have more demand. One of the other things is that we will have what we call adoption barrels, which are barrels that we, they're under Patrick's guidance the whole way, but they're not sold prior to harvest. And so then after that, hey, this barrel wasn't sold and it needs a home and a family. And so, and if that doesn't go to that, then we quickly move it into like usually our Foundry or Anarchist programs. And so people can jump in at any point in time. And so we get a lot of companies that'll want to do corporate gifting and want to really deliver a high-end product. We have a lot of clients overseas, especially and on the East Coast, and some universities that do it as well, where they'll come to us and they'll buy those barrels and then blend them up. Or sometimes they'll just say, Patrick, you do the blend. We trust you. You know what we like.
Yeah, we have alumni dinner or whatever. I want to do whatever it is.
That's
so it's
flexibility.
It's,
yeah, it's cool that. And as Steve said, you wouldn't have, people don't have this access to this fruit at all. And you wouldn't be able to make a custom wine. Even if you did have access to it, you wouldn't have, it wouldn't be able to be custom for sure. And
level of detail you described is really just like
heavy. Yeah, no, it's tough to do. I mean, quite frankly, for
you
us.
You haven't gotten this. Patrick's job's really
hard. You might not have gotten this part that I said. I think it's really difficult to do these things, but.
We're doing this on a Friday,
I think it's an amazing opportunity, though, and I have the real pleasure to work with, professionals and people from all over the world, from all different types, that are making wine just because they want to, not because they have to, or not because even that they need to, because they want to do it. And so, to me, that's a real to get to spend the moments with people in their lives where they want to be there, where they are, is a real satisfying. It's a real satisfying thing. Again, there's plenty of opportunities and examples of where people just have to be at a certain place and time, or they are just by mistake or by coincidence. But nobody comes here by coincidence or by mistake. No one comes to see me or to blend the wines. They buy their wines by chance. It's because they want to do it. It's all intentional. And so it's real fun to spend the and a lot of times too, particularly for our clients, it's a really they're doing it to reward themselves. It's a real I don't think it's selfish at all. I think it's a real satisfying, but it's kind of a reward, and they like to be around wine. They've worked really hard and gotten to the point in their career that they're able to afford to produce their own wine, and so to share those moments with people is very satisfying. And so it really is a cool experience to it's different. I've also made wines for normal brands and for just normal wineries that where it's one single owner. And that was also satisfying to make a wine that's very, that people can come to, and it's just one brand or one story. But we do something way more than that. We make hundreds of brands and hundreds of stories and hundreds of different reasons why, and catalysts behind these different brands. And they're all across the board from just trying to impress people to having something that's, again, to most of the reason why I am making wine is because they want to do it. And so it's just, that's a fun thing to cross people's paths in their lives, to cross their lives at moments where they're doing things for themselves, or at their kind of their peaks of their life, or their high points, or the reasons where they're, it's really fun to see and experience, you know, that aspect of their life, because they are kind of at their highest, perhaps at their highest points, or among their highest points in their life. It's a really gratifying position to be in for me personally to do that and to share that with them. Is it's a drinking wine's fun together, do together. Making wine's also really fun together because it's very satisfying. It's challenging because if you hadn't done it before, you don't realize all the steps that goes into it. But once you do, then you have that much more appreciation for why and how you enjoyed those amazing wines. Almost anyone could tell you about, if they like wine, about a certain wine that just spoke to them. And I can do it for sure. And DRC in mid-90s, you know, just jumped out of the glass at me and said, holy cow, this is what you should be doing. This is what you should be doing more frequently, enjoying this wine or thinking about wine and enjoying it this to this level. So it's really, to me, I take a lot of, like I said, a real lot of personal satisfaction in that, and sharing those moments with people. And so they become, our clients are our friends, they're our clients for sure, but they become part of it and become family, really. And so few better things in life than sharing good moments with family.
Well, you know, thinking about what you're saying is really quite extraordinary, because as we all know, Napa is a very heavily visited wine region. And there's lots of others, of course, and people come there in order to experience what it's like to be a part of that world. And they're looking to catch the magic, that transference between the land and the maker, and how they relate to the final product. And here you're offering an opportunity to do something that's so intense, because it's their personality that also is reflected, that symbiosis that happens in that collaborative process. That's really quite something.
You say a little bit more eloquently than I did, but that was nice. I'll just say I agree with you. It's a pretty cool process, no doubt about it.
It gives people a slice of why we got into this in the first place, you know, and because everybody has that. I mean, before we started recording, I think we were talking, or maybe we were recording, I don't remember now, it's been a while, but we were talking about the romance of it all.
Yeah.
And, you know, that it's, it, you know, talks about, you know, the romance of a golden retriever, as I pet my dog Bella here, who's a golden retriever. A golden retriever running through the vineyards as you stroll through the vines, you know, smelling your wine and whatnot. And really the reality is she's 13, blind, deaf, and in a industrial park warehouse winery. So it's totally different, but there's still that romance that you find in connecting with the people and their and seeing it through their connections of the wines and what their goals are for doing it and all of that, you know. And so, because the same thing, I always thought like, oh yes, it would be so romantic to just get into the wine industry, and zero idea what I was getting into when I got into it, but I absolutely loved every second of it. Well, like 90% of the second.
There's a few seconds you could have probably.
Yeah.
You know, you so eloquently put early in the conversation, you don't know till you know. So knowing what you know now, would you do anything differently?
Oh, that's a good question.
Mm. Yeah, I'd do some different things on wines for sure. It's hard when you're making products. You have to go with the amount of experience and knowledge that you have at any one time, and you have to if you're being a painter or you're a chef or you're a sculptor, you have an X amount of skill and logistics and product available to you, and you have to produce a product. And so this is the product that you make, and then over time, after you've done it more and more and more, and your skills and your experience and your and knowledge becomes more and more attuned to especially a product like wine that's moving and evolving over time, you can really see very quickly how you did, and particularly if you're paying attention to it. And so much like you could as an artist, and you can see the picture and you see the mistakes that you made or the good texture that you made or whatever it is, it's definitely it's clear, particularly once you've done it over and over and over again, how you did. And so if you're paying attention enough then and being honest enough to know that probably the early times you did it, the less experience you had, the less quality that you probably gave, you know. And so just like cooking, you definitely gain from doing it and paying attention to see the result. And you undercook things and you overcook things, and you cook something just right. And it's knowing the touch and knowing when to say when and when to keep and when to adjust and when to not adjust is the hardest part. Good chefs, you know, if it were easy, every dish you had would be amazing. And that's not the way, or every wine you had were amazing. And that's not the way that works. You have amazing wine when the conditions are amazing and the fruit was amazing and the winemaking judgment was amazing. That's how you have amazing wine. And so it sounds pretty simple. It's pretty elusive for most.
It's all timing.
It's all about timing and
conditions and, yeah.
The devil's in the details, for sure. I read the other day, God is in the details, perhaps, too. Well, maybe they're both in the details.
Both, yeah, right. Everybody's got to be in there somewhere.
And so it is it's a real fun thing to do. We have a real... And you can making wine all over the world, I think, is a pretty rewarding experience. Our particular slice of the market and of wines and of winemaking is so unique, and so that it brings something that you couldn't do anywhere else. And as far as I know, we offer something that nobody can do anywhere else. And so it is very satisfying and rewarding and challenging all at the same time, because we're doing things again that, as far as we know, haven't been done before to this level, and it's quite a slice to think.
I don't know that I'd do anything different. Yeah, I think that, you know, he has the hindsight of, you know, looking back on a wine and you know, but there's so many more variables in his world for that for me it's everything's kind of led to another thing, and I really enjoy it. I love the team that we've built here. We've got a fantastic crew. You know, there's, I don't know, 24 of us or something like that here, 23, about to be more for harvest. But, you know, we have a very long-standing core and other folks that we don't have much turnover, and I'm very proud of that. And I think when I look at it at the end of the day from an operations standpoint and a strategic thinking standpoint, I don't know that I would do anything different.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I think that everything we've, we've certainly achieved some pretty high marks, I think, on most of the wines and we've created and so forth. But everything we've done, we've learned from and we've grown from. So without that knowledge, without having done it and knowing the results from that, you wouldn't be to the point where you are right now, right? So I think our wines, at the risk of sounding arrogant, compete with world class, our world class level, and we compete against. I'd put it up against any wines from wherever. And so, with that being said, the only way we could get to that point is working with world class quality grapes and having world class quality logistics at the winery, and making a number of wines and learning from that. And so, that's how you achieve in life and in work. Is by trying and then reflecting and adjusting if necessary. And so,
You mentioned we're in the industrial park in Napa, but I kind of feel like this is a pretty magical spot. Like a combination of spa, I feel very clean because the golden retriever that we were just referencing earlier, mm-hmm. she cleaned me so well onto the table. it's awesome. There's so much... thoughtfulness here, that there's depth, there's integrity, there's camaraderie.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
There's so much to be had here, and the wines are terrific. We barely even spoke of the lovely bottles that are in front of us on the table, but they spoke for themselves. We're all very much enjoying tasting throughout the conversation. So I certainly hope that listeners take to heart that there's a lot to be found with respect to the anarchist, in terms of whimsy, in terms of intellectual and palatal stimulation, and more than anything, that human factor that you just spoke of, the team behind it, there's that transference, and I'm very grateful to have learned a bit about it, and I can't wait to follow your wines.
Mm-hmm.
Thank
Cheers.
You.
That was very nice. Yeah,
Thank you so much.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.